the reason that America has fared so well is because our employment has actually been fairly strong. I mean, we were expecting it not to be strong, and that's actually why the Fed kept raising interest rates.
Welcome to the Rent to Retirement Podcast, your resource for passive real estate investing and retirement strategies. If you're new to real estate or planning your financial future, you're in the right place. Join us at renttoretirement.com to find your path to financial freedom and an easy, carefree retirement. Enjoy the show.
Hey, Rent to Retirees, it's Adam Schrader here with another episode, and I am joined today by Avi Shemesh. He is the co-founder, senior managing member, and chief acquisitions officer at Amerinote Exchange. And we're going to be talking today about, if you guess it based on the name of his company, some notes, which we haven't talked about much in our podcast. But Avi, thanks for joining us today.
Well, Adam, thank you very much for having me. I appreciate the opportunity.
Well, it's a pleasure. So tell us a little bit about your real estate journey so far. How did you get started and kind of what's kept you in the field?
Wow, that's I appreciate that. Yeah, so as far as the journey of my real estate, path, we'll say, it all started back in the late 90s, early 2000s with, of course, the repealing of Glass-Steagall, which kind of opened the floodgates for the subprime mortgage market and the furious movement towards the growth of the mortgage market in that time. And that's really when I entered as a very green junior loan officer out of an outfit in Pennsylvania. And very typical mortgage loan originations. And as I continued my path in originations, I expanded with another outfit in the New Jersey area, which was commercial residential across 16 states. And in doing so, some of the mortgage lenders, mortgage bankers, mortgage brokers may resonate with what I'm about to say, but they have banks. Particularly, we did a lot of business with First Horizon. We did a lot of business with Lehman Brothers, of course, now crashed. We did a lot of business with Bear Stearns and other institutions. And these institutions would send account reps to our office to basically promote their new loan products, which there were many of in that day that were coming out. So we were approached by our Bear Stearns account manager, came in one day and said, "Hey, this is your new account rep. I'm heading over to acquisitions. See you later." And, that was all well and good. And I, before he took office, what's acquisitions? What is this? And it was, a big education for me where it was kind of described that acquisitions, once the loan is created, these loans are then traded between institutions, pension funds, wealth funds, family offices, high net worth individuals, private lenders. And there's a whole back end to the mortgage business, which really provides the liquidity needed for the front end mortgage market, which is, of course, the primary mortgage market, also referred to as originations. And that really piqued my interest. This was, 2003. So as I continued my research into the secondary mortgage market, which is the trading of mortgage assets once they're created, that led me to the founding and creation into Amerinote Exchange into the secondary mortgage market. And we founded this company in late 2005, early 2006, and we've been off and going and running ever since.
Yeah. So how did y'all do during the Great Recession? You said talking about 2003, and then that happened. So tell us a little bit about how your journey went through the Great Recession.
Thank you for asking that. So
thanks for bringing up such memories.
So do you remember, I'm going to just kind of divert here. There was a scene in the movie Forrest Gump, if anyone's ever seen that, where the shrimping industry, the hurricane came in and the only one left standing was Forrest Gump waving on the boat when Lieutenant Dan showed up. That's kind of our story there a little bit, right? So we had, we were a small outfit with low overhead. We were providing a a unique service to a unique market. We started in the seller finance space, and I can address, you know, the seller finance owner carry space versus the institutional space. And in doing so, we actually we started getting a lot of lift, right? Right before leading up to 2007, early 2008. And even after September 15th, 2008, the infamous day when they were trying to, you know, it was really, the word was out that the banks were in trouble. We still had pretty good momentum and lift. Now, of course, when early 2009 hit, all the way through the beginning of 2010, we didn't close one transaction. We didn't see one transaction close. But because we were built, we were always built for mobility. What I mean by that is we were always built as a remote office. We always wanted to focus on remote workers. We didn't necessarily have a lot of overhead. We had a lot of capital connections. We had a lot of, you know, lead gen, because in the mortgage origination space, I was doing, even though I was affiliated with a company, I would also do lead generation on the side to bolster my book of business. So I just applied that to the to the secondary loan market. So I had a really good feel for how to generate, cultivate, and harvest our own leads. And in the secondary market space at that time, there was very few folks that were doing what we were doing. So we had a very unique advantage. What I'm referring to is a digital advantage, right? So there wasn't a lot of digital presence for our competitors at all. I mean, it was quite frankly, very easy to break into the space at that time using marketing tactics that were being used, say, in other industries that weren't being applied in the mortgage note buying space. So we really thrived through that market, with the exception of the fact that we were, it's not that we weren't getting leads between 2009 and early 2010. It's that no one was saying yes to the offers. And if they were saying yes to the offers, which there were a bunch, that we would send appraisers out to do the appraisals. And if you recall, the values were dropping so drastically and so quickly that the appraisals would never come in where we thought they were, and that would shift our loan to value ratio or investment to value ratio, and then sometimes just kill that deal on the vine. So it's not that we weren't closing deals because we were missing out on opportunities. It was just the nature of the economic landscape was kind of boxing us into a certain corner that we were negotiating at that time. So we negotiated our way through that, came out on the other side very, very strong, and have been thriving ever since.
And now, working in the mortgage side of things and the originations and all of that, how would you compare, you know, a lot of people leading up to this were very concerned about, you know, oh, we're going to go into another great recession type situation. We've been saying, you know, that's not very likely to happen because lending standards are completely different now than they were there. Kind of, how would you assess the state of where we are today and over the last 1 to 2 years, as opposed to where we were leading up into the Great Recession?
That is a very unique question, and I appreciate the opportunity to answer that. I would say the major difference, first and foremost, is that we are, back then, we were dealing with a toxic mortgage issue, right? So there was a lot of toxic mortgages, you know, filtering through the system that were creating friction points, more than friction points, but I'll just use the word friction points, that created the issues that we were dealing with at that time. The major difference between then and now, and what we're going to, in my opinion, and from our company's calculation, what we're going to see in the coming months, probably, if I had to, really predict when this would probably happen, but sometime around late summer of this year, we're going to start seeing the major difference is going to be an employment issue, right? So aside, we didn't have inflation then, right? We have the inflation issue now. We didn't have the M2 money supply was not nearly as large as it was then that it is now. They had to obviously bring that back because of the quantitative easing that was going on over the course of the past, the 2010s in general. But when you have this inflationary environment, you know, there was a lot of downward pressure on the powers that be to tamp down. They decided to tamp down on demand as opposed to increase supply. We can kind of get into that in more detail. But they, you know, the Federal Reserve and the powers that be decided to raise interest rates to combat inflation. And it's very clear that Powell, Jerome Powell, the head of the Federal Reserve, doesn't want to make the same mistakes as Volcker did in the 80s, which is, you know, letting his foot off the gas too soon and seeing inflation, you know, spin wildly out of control by reducing rates too soon, right? So that's what they made it very clear that they're going to continue raising rates. So the major difference now is that we're going to have an employment issue this time around. Now, last time around, there was, you know, the toxic mortgage. This time around, it's not, it's going to be, as they say, history does not necessarily repeat itself, but it does rhyme. And the way it's going to rhyme here is that we're going to see that the employment issue is going to get worse and worse as the year progresses onward, just like our allies and our friends over in Europe, in Australia, and other Western societies. The reason that America has fared so well is because our employment has actually been fairly strong. I mean, we were expecting it not to be strong, and that's actually why the Fed kept raising interest rates. To be honest, we should be a little bit concerned, not concerned, but you should see that the wave is about to break right when the Fed goes, okay, we're going to pause here. The reason that they most likely would pause the interest rate hike is not because they defeated inflation, it's because they see the wave of unemployment coming. And at this point, they can't, you know, they don't want to, you know, knock us off kilter and just have us completely fall over and repeat something, say, of 29, the depression of 29. So that is our take on this, right? So the difference is not toxic mortgages. It's going to be an unemployment issue in combination with the inflationary environment that we're currently navigating and other geopolitical aspects, of course.
Yeah. So how has the, you know, you have an interesting viewpoint from being inside the banking industry, some with originations and everything. Does what happened with SVB recently, is that going to impact, how is that going to impact things? Or is it kind of over and done with because the government stepped in and backed things? Or kind of what impact does that have?
So that's a good question. I obviously am on the sidelines, just like everyone else. And, you know, I'm not, you know, in these meetings or fly on the wall when these discussions are being had. But I will say that if you are doing your diligence and looking at the environment around you, it's very clear that this is not going to stop with Silicon Valley Bank. It's not going to stop with First Republic, and it's most certainly not going to stop with Signature. We are of the opinion that this is going to be an issue that drips through the rest of the year. You're going to have spurts of chaos, we'll say, banking chaos, with other spurts of stability, and it's going to be really like a game of whack-a-mole. Now, what banks are going to be affected by this is hard to say, but I am pretty sure that in the end, there's going to be a couple of major banks left. And those couple of major banks are probably going to be Chase. It's probably going to be maybe Wells Fargo, you know, and others. But I definitely think that you are not, the show is not over. We are going to see more bank turbulence, whether it's bank failures remains to be seen, but bank turbulence and how this affects the overall economy will definitely, that can play out a couple different ways, but it will definitely create instability, a trust issue, movement into different types of assets, maybe more sound assets, some would say, whether that be, you know, treasuries, whether that be gold, physical or stock, real estate in certain jurisdictions. These are safe haven assets, I guess you can say. the other side of that is how it affects the institutional. So what we see is a lot of banks, especially over the past 3 weeks, when all of this happened, we got bombarded with banks panic shopping. They weren't panic selling, and they most certainly weren't panic buying, but we had a lot of high level executives and their junior executives approach us specifically, and I'm assuming companies like us, to say, hey guys and gals, this, you know, what would you guys give us for this? What would you guys pay for that? We're thinking about this exit strategy on this loan portfolio to free up cash. This loan portfolio is only averaging a weighted average coupon rate of 3.81%. And because inflation 6.9%, we're about 4% underwater, 3% underwater. We need to jettison this and recycle our capital into other investments that are going to pay a higher yield. This has been a lot of the conversation. Now, there's been some banks that we were pricing some of their assets that have been jumping on it. There's been other banks that have been saying, well, we're just going to kind of wait and see. And really, what in my humble opinion, this whole thing with OPEC, I don't know if your listeners or if anyone has kind of been paying attention, hasn't really been getting a lot of coverage, but the OPEC plus states, which is the Middle Eastern plus Russia, have been saying, look, we are drawing back on oil supply. And that is the other, in my opinion, that's the other side of the equation, right? So the Federal Reserve has decided to tamp down on inflation by stamping down on demand, by raising interest rates, in effect, making everyone poorer, evaporating everyone's buying power so they can tamp down on demand. Another solution, in our opinion, very well may be to flood the market with supply, to flood the market with energy, right? So when you have a market flooded with energy, that very well may also combat in a certain way inflation as well. So that you know, if we were more, again, not condoning or condemning, but if we were more of an oil producing country, that there may be a good balance of raising interest rates and flooding the market with energy supply. That would be, in my opinion, a much quicker way to tamp down on inflation. So there's a lot of moving parts here. But to answer your question, back to the question at hand, banks like Silicon Valley Bank, there will be more failures. There will be more turbulence. It affects the retail market differently than it would affect the institutional market. And both of them will be affected one way or the other, as I just described.
Yeah. So when you talk about what you're doing now, where you are in the real estate field with note investing, first off, can you just give a brief overview for people about what note investing actually is?
Sure, absolutely. So there's different sections of the industry, right? So I'm going to just kind of start where we started. And that was when we started, I was an institutional. I dealt with a lot of institutions. I was a mortgage loan originator, or worked for a mortgage loan originator. And in my research, I found that there was a very underserved market in the owner-financed or seller-financed space. Just so some of your listeners understand, an owner-financed mortgage loan or a contract for deed in some states, it's called. It's not exactly the same thing, but still same idea, same ballpark. Or a real estate contract in other states. This would be when, let's just say, the Jones family is selling a property. They own the property, let's just say, free and clear. And then the Smith family comes along and says, hey, we want to buy your property. I'm self-employed. I want to buy your $150,000 property. I got about $50,000 cash. I have decent credit, but the bank won't give me a loan because I'm self-employed. So the Jones family would say, well, you know what? This is what I'm going to do. I'll take your $50,000 as a down payment, and then I will finance you the equity in my property at 7% over the next 20 or 30 years. Let's just call it 30 years. And from that point on, you would, in certain states, most states, you can go to a title company. You would put together something called a mortgage note or a promissory note. In addition to that, you would put something together called a security instrument, which has different names in certain states. It could be called a deed of trust. It could be called a mortgage. It could be called, in certain states, somewhat a land contract or a real estate contract. And that will tether the promissory note to the actual property. So those two documents together create, in most states, a legal lien or a legal debt, just like Wells Fargo or Bank of America would have. And in that being said, the owner, the Jones family, will seller finance the equity of their property to the Smith family. And it's just like a regular mortgage. And usually what happens is, you know, over that 30 years, they can, I mean, that could be a retirement account at 7% for the Jones family. They're just like, look, I'm getting 7% on my money every month. The payment comes in, and maybe, they'll sell the property early and we'll cash out. Maybe they won't. I mean, it's really kind of up in the air at that point. But usually around year 12, 24, 36 months in, a lot of these, we call them one-off private lenders, will reach out to us and say, hey, you know, I really like this investment property down the street. We have this $600 trickling in every month. It's great, but I really want, you know, the $98,000 that I'm owed, you know, because they've paid down the balance about $2,000. We got about $98,000 tied up here. I just really want to cash out. So they'll do a Google search. They'll find a company like ours. And once they speak to someone like us, they'll find out that they can sell that $98,000 mortgage loan between $75,000 and $85,000, $90,000, depending on the characteristics. And some folks may jump on that, others may not, but we do typically buy at a discount, typically lower than what they're owed. And I can kind of get into the mechanics of that. And that's typically the primary market that we serve, right? So I would say about 60% of the folks that come across our desk are seller finance. And that doesn't have to be one-off loans. I mean, we have a lot of contractors. We have a lot of developers that carry back notes, a lot of builders that carry back notes, bail bonds, companies that carry back notes in the form of second liens. So we deal both with private lenders on the corporate side, private lenders on the retail side, and then about the other 40% of our business are credit unions and banks that are looking to exit or find an off ramp for their portfolio. So we can then, you know, provide liquidity, or a company like us can provide liquidity for them to recycle their capital in any way they see fit as well. So that's typically the explanation behind the mortgage loan acquisition space.
Okay. So let's say I'm someone interested in investing in notes. You know, I find the, I think in your example, the Joneses had the note from the Smiths. And they come to me and say, you know, Adam, I want to, you know, I've got this note for 98 grand, but, you know, we want the money now to go buy the property like you were talking about. What I essentially, let's say we agreed on, I don't know, 80 or 85 grand for the note. Is that something that then people go, I'm assuming the answer is no, but people go and get financed to buy that? Or is it, I have to have 85 grand today to hand to them to get the note from them?
So if you're trying to buy a note from the Joneses,
yes,
then you would need to hand them 85 grand. How you get that 85 grand is up to you, but you want to make sure that you're juggling a line of credit or some sort of leverage, that you're borrowing for less than what your yield requirement is. And that's typically why there's a discount, is because there's a dislocation between the 7%. So if, when you go to borrow money in real estate, right, there's thousands of banks in our country that lend money on some form of real estate, whether it's residential, commercial, bare land, thousands, right? When you try to borrow money on to buy notes, that's not real estate. That is considered esoteric financial instrument. That's considered to be annuities, structured settlements, mortgage notes, business notes, lawsuit advances. These are esoteric assets. There's not thousands of banks or investment firms that will lend money on that. So what you would be looking for is something called like note on note financing, right? So that's the basic term. You can also get some sort of credit facility, warehouse line where you're warehousing these things. You can also participate through joint venture. In our industry, we call it syndication, where we're syndicating with a high net worth individual, we're syndicating with a family office. And then in some cases, you could just buy the loan. Let's say you have $87,000 in your bank account. You can buy the loan for $85,000 and then immediately, like wholesaling, you flip it off just like you would wholesale property. You would flip it off to a end buyer, and you would, you know, arbitrage the difference. So let's say you have a buyer for a a 91, they'll buy it from you from 91,000. You can make a quick $6,000-$7,000 on a flip there, if you so desire. But there is a dislocation between the real estate market interest rate environment and the esoteric market interest rate environment. That's typically why these are bought at a discount. The other reason why they're bought at a discount is because it's a very illiquid market. Now, you and I probably both know, and I'm sure some of your listeners know, and maybe all of your listeners know, that real estate in general is an illiquid market, right? So a liquid market being you go to TD Ameritrade and you sell your Tesla stock and you hit a button and then boom, 5 seconds later, you got all of your money in your account. Same thing with Bitcoin or Ethereum, very liquid. With real estate, takes what? 2 weeks to find a, if you're going through a realtor, 2-3 weeks to get it onboarded with a realtor, you know, another 30, 45, 50 days to close it with their lender. It takes some time. That's an illiquid market. The same process occurs in the note sale space, right? So the average note can be transacted on within 30 days. It could be as quick as 2 weeks once all the documentation and negotiation occurs. It's very similar to the same type of process. But the notes buying space is even more illiquid than the real estate space because you have less folks that are participating in that market. So with that, if you're bringing liquidity to an extremely illiquid market, the same way that someone would buy a bar of gold or an ounce of gold, they pay spot price. They try to sell that piece of gold or that bar of gold. They're going to pay more. If they're trying to buy it, they're going to pay more than what the gold is actually worth on the market that day. It's over, you know, spot. And then if they're trying to sell it, it's usually going to be at a discount, slight discount, that being said, when they sell it to whoever they sell it to. And the reason why is because gold itself, physical gold itself, is an illiquid market. So the same types of laws of physics occur in the note buying space, very similar to bond trading.
So how does, you know, people who are looking at, you know, real estate and rental properties, you know, essentially how to vet out a real estate deal. And if not, it's fairly easy to figure out how to vet it out. The numbers are there. You can do it that way. How does one, when, if you're getting into the note buying business and not necessarily business, but investing, you know, you're not starting up your own note company, but you know, you're starting to get invested in notes. Let's just say I look at the Joneses deal. How do I determine that it's a good thing to actually invest in?
Thank you for that. It's a very good question. Very thoughtful and very, necessary to understand. So the first thing any note buyer should look at is how much money was put as a down payment. Let's assume this is an arm's length transaction sale, not a refi, not some weird modification, because there's different flavors of loans, but let's just call it a traditional standard property that was sold and a note was taken back in exchange. The very first thing that any note buyer should look for, how much money was put as a down payment. The higher the dollar amount, the more money the note will sell for. If you put 10% down and you have a 30-year loan structure, let's just say you have a 5% interest rate, which is underperforming the current market. If someone were to walk into Wells Fargo today, they would be, you know, with perfect W-2s, good credit, they would be about 7.5, maybe 7.25 on a full 30-year, maybe 6.5 or 6.875 on some sort of ARM product, adjustable rate mortgage. But if you're charging 5% on a seller finance note, which I don't recommend that you're doing, and then you go in and you go, well, wait a second now. They put 10% down. They have 5% baked into the contract. And it amortizes over 30 years, which is a hell of a long time to wait for a return on investment. Granted, you're going to make a lot of interest. And if that's your investment strategy to really set it and forget it for 30 years, then, you know, more power to you. Most note buyers like to be out of an investment within the first 5 to 10 years to recycle their capital as well. So the very first thing you're looking at is a down payment. 15% should be the bare floor minimum, bare floor minimum. And we can talk about different buying structures. I'm talking about buying the whole note, right? So think of it as like one pizza pie. We're buying the whole pie. There's transactions where you can buy slices of that pizza pie or slices, bite-sized portions of the note. We can talk about that, but let's just assume for 1 second we're talking about something called a full purchase buyout where you're buying the whole note for a certain dollar amount. Then you hyper-focus on how much. So on a $100,000 loan, $150,000 sale price we'll use as our example with the Joneses and the Smith, $150,000, there should be at least 20% is about $30,000 down, $35,000, so what's that? 30,000 down, 45,000 should be about 30%. So they put 50,000 down in our example. That's a fantastic offer. So that right there, you can check that off the list if that looks good, right? So on a $100,000 loan, $150,000 sale price, they put down 50,000, excuse me. And that's a good down payment. So 15% should be the bare floor minimum. Anything under 15%, the discount should be really, really much, much steeper because you need to build in that emergency runway equity position just in case there's a crash landing in the form of a foreclosure or default. So again, 15% is bare minimum, 20% is average, 25% is definitely trending in the right direction. Anything north of 25% is a deal. Like you take, you know, you really, it's a good note structure. The second thing that any note buyer is going to look at is going to be the loan terms and amortization. What the interest rate is, what the payback period is, those two items will determine how much. So the first item, which is the down payment, will determine the security of the asset that in someone's portfolio. How secure will that note be in someone's portfolio? The loan terms and amortization determine how much money the note will sell for, right? So the higher the interest rate, assuming that you're staying within usury laws of the state that the property exists in. So the higher the interest rate, the more money the note sells for. And the shorter the payback period, the more money the note sells for, and vice versa. So if you have a 7% rate, 8% rate, 9% rate on a 10-year loan, 120-month loan with 25% down, that is a very, very pretty note. Now, as far as the loan structure, that's very, very pretty. The next focus would be on the collateral. Where's the property located? Who's living in the property? What's the usage of the property? Is the property in an area that's seeing some economic decline? Are they using it for Airbnb? Is it vacant? Is it occupied? So really, the ones that are the most attractive are owner-occupied single-family residences where it's the roof over the head of the borrower making payments, assuming that it aligns with the Dodd-Frank regulation, which most seller finance transactions do because it's just one and done. There's very few people that do more than one seller finance transaction in their lifetime, let alone in 1 year. So as long as it's less than one a year, it does fall within the compliance of Dodd-Frank. So if it's a consumer loan and it's the roof over the borrower's head, that's typically the most attractive. Just like if you were to walk into a bank and you were trying to borrow money, they would say, is it owner occupied? Okay, your rate's lower. Oh, it's tenant occupied? Okay, your rate goes up. We get dinged the same way in the esoteric investment space, right? So the mortgage note buying space. So again, owner occupancy, very, very attractive. Tenant occupied, definitely attractive, but you should build in more in your yield and what you plan on making on an ROI on something like that. But once you start getting into, you know, 5% down, 3% interest rate stretched over 30 years. And let's say the loan balance is $100,000 on that, right? Like they only put $3,000 down on a $103,000 sale price. And now they have $100,000 to pay, you know, 3% over the life of the loan or, you know, 30 years. That loan will sell for about 50 cents on the dollar, 60 cents on the dollar, because they didn't take a good down payment. They have a horrible, atrocious interest rate when you hold it to the backdrop of the rate environment that's going on. And they stretched it over 30 years, which is an extremely long time. So there's many, many multiple moving parts. And I just want to add one more thing, not dominate this time that we have here. But I will say that credit score sensitivity does come into play, as well as borrower background, right? So I'm not suggesting that you pull credit, but you want to make sure that you're, although if you could, you want to make sure no foreclosures, no bankruptcies, no unpaid child support, no tax liens. These are construed as deal killers.
Yeah. Now, some of our listeners that we talk to are doing, you know, creative financing, seller financing deals. It seems like your company has like a buying and selling platform on it based on the exchange part. Can you talk a little bit about what y'all are offering with your company?
Sure. So just to clarify, and I know the language may be a little confusing, and I can kind of go back to the original intent, but the original intent of the company was to be an exchange, a full-blown exchange. And we dabbled with that back in the early, you know, during our creation back in the 2000s. And of course, we changed our model, which was one of the reasons that we changed our model when 2008 happened. we decided not to be an exchange, although we were married to the name at that point. So we kind of rolled with it. So Marinode Exchange is a direct purchaser of mortgage assets across all spectrums of performance levels, whether the payments are on time, whether the payments are not on time, whether the payments are on time. Sometimes, you know, we can do all collateral types, residential, commercial, bare land, mobile home, special use, environmental. I mean, there's a slew of different property types that we do. We can also do any kind of lien position, senior liens, which are the first position, junior liens, which are second, third, and so forth. So we do a plethora of different flavors in the loan acquisition space. And who we serve are lenders who are looking to exit or are looking for an off-ramp for their current situation, whether they are performing some sort of lifestyle change, whether that's just cashing out, you know, moving to Hawaii, moving to Florida, moving to Mexico, whatever that may be, or it's a investor that's looking to recycle their capital into a higher yielding instrument like another note. There's a lot of investors, believe it or not, that are selling their 3% rate notes that they've originated over the past 12 years, and they're recycling that into, believe it or not, treasuries, because treasuries are paying more nowadays, you know, and they're a very liquid, very safe asset. So that is who we serve, both private and institutional lenders. We also provide services such as hypothecation or hypothecation lending, which is a very unique, exotic type of loan product, which would allow, you know, some people would say, hey, I don't want to sell my note and take a discount. I just need cash. Well, a hypothecation loan would allow a mortgage lender, whether private or institutional, to pledge their performing loan as collateral and borrow against it up to 60%, depending on the jurisdiction in which the property is located. And that is another product, again, very exotic loan product that we are providing in our services. And we're also working on an asset-based lending product, which would allow landlords, let's say you have 52 performing or 52 cash flowing doors, whether they be single families or apartments or whatever, and you want to expand your footprint in a certain market, you can pledge your rental properties or, you know, cash flowing rental properties as collateral. And then you can borrow against it up to 50 or 60%. So that's another loan product that we're working on. But this is who we serve, typically the lender and investor community.
All right. Well, thank you so much. There's so much more to dive into in the no business. I think we might have to have you back on, or else we could end up talking for hours and hours on this. But the website for everybody listening is amerinoteexchange.com. The exchange does not have an E in it, so it is just a one note. One E, AmerinoteExchange.com. Abby, is there anything else you want to leave our listeners with before we wrap it up?
All I want to say is I greatly appreciate the ability to discuss this industry on your platform. And I invite anyone listening to stop by and check us out. We would love to hear if there's any suggestions on products that may be helpful for folks in the, you know, the residential or commercial real estate side of things. And we'd love to see you stop by.
All right. Well, thank you so much. Again, the website is AmerinoteExchange.com. If you have any questions for us, or if you want me to pass anything along to Abby, you can email podcasts@renttoretirement.com. That's podcasts@renttoretirement.com. And don't forget to go to renttoretirement.com and find the single family homes you could buy and then use as a collateral to get that loan he was talking about if you need. That's at renttoretirement.com. You can schedule a call there. Don't forget, if you leave a review on your podcast platform, take a screenshot, send it to us. We'll enter you into a $500 closing cost credit raffle, as well as send you a $10 thank you gift card. And if you want Zach's copy of Top 20 Markets to Invest in 2023, you can email that to podcasts@renttoretirement.com as well. Thank you so much for taking the time to educate yourselves today. We'll talk to you on the next episode.